So we are continuing chapter 8 of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which canto 3. We're almost finished with this chapter. And I was going to start with Rishi's questions from last week, but wait until he finishes paying obeisances. So anyone know a good joke or something in the meantime? Hare Krishna. I'm proofreading Burijan Prabhu's book on the overview of the 11th and 12th canto. Just finished it. Yeah, yesterday. It's a 580-page book. So I never did a lot of studying of the 11th and 12th canto. An interesting ringtone. I changed my ringtone from a cow to something called Krishna's flute. I found it on some ringtone website. So it plays Krishna. Because I found that the cow one kind of startled a few people at work. All of a sudden we're in a meeting and go, moo. What? Where's the cow in East Street, Northwest. So it's very, the 11th and 12th cantos are actually amazing cantos. The book is called The Backward Glance, because looking back at the 10th canto, like that. It's not out yet. I just finished the proofreading, and it'll take a few months probably to publish and print. But very, Uddhava Gita is an amazing book. It's the Bhagavad Gita, but with longer and with more emphasis on bhakti. And then I just finished the pastime of Markandeya Rishi. None of us should ever ask the question Markandeya Rishi asked. He said, "My dear Lord, please show me your illusory energy." Don't do that. Don't do that. He saw it. Okay. So Rishi asked last week at the end of class, and there wasn't enough time to answer it. It sounded like it was a two-part question. I want to make sure I got it right. What should we think when reading these sections, and especially if we find them a little less interesting than other sections? Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I have a few thoughts on this topic. One thought is that there's something in most Vedic literature, or I don't know if it's all, I'm just saying most because there may be an exception, called the Paribhasya Sutra. And that is the king verse, that all other verses in that, all other topics and verses in that work point towards. Okay? And does anyone know the Paribhasya Sutra for Srimad Bhagavatam? No? No? First canto, I'll give you a hint, chapter 3. Ete Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam. Yes, Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam. So the idea is that directly or indirectly, all verses point towards that, that Krishna is. That there's the verse just named all the different incarnations, I think like 28 of them or something, right? And then they say, Ete Chakkalapungsam, Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam. That Krishna is the avatari or the origin of all the avatars. And so Srila Jiva Goswami says all the verses point directly or indirectly to that conclusion. So one of the adventures, one could say, in reading the Bhagavatam and reading things like we've been reading about creation is, how is this connected to Krishna's to Bhagavan Swayam? And I think we can make the connection if we think about it deeply enough. And then I thought, well, really, if we look at often in Srila Prabhupada's purports, he makes that connection. Even if, it's talking about, he'll bring it back to bhakti. Right, even that one scholar once criticized Srila Prabhupada that in his purports to the Bhagavad Gita, he'll take certain words like Brahman or things like that, and say this is Krishna. And the scholar, one scholar said, you know, this is not appropriate. Why does he put Krishna where Krishna isn't? And Prabhupada said, he has understood me. Because he understood the, you know, if you trace it back, what is the source of Brahman? Parabrahman. Who's Parabrahman? Vishnu. Who's the source of Vishnu? Krishna. You know, so he was just doing the math, so to speak, like that. So Prabhupada does that. He'll take some of these purports will be about, you know, think about Krishna himself or about who we are and things like that, even though maybe talking about, you know, ether comes from, you know, earth comes from fire, comes from, you know, or things like that. And then I was thinking, obviously not in the way that Srila Prabhupada does it, and certainly not to the perfection that Srila Prabhupada, but I try my little efforts to make those kind of connections sometimes as we're having this class. So that was one point. Any thoughts on that? It's kind of like, you know, we're supposed to look out in the world and see the philosophy, see Krishna. You know, we look at a tree and see, oh, there's a soul inside that tree. So similarly, look at different parts of the Bhagavatam and see how it's connected. Microphone? Padma to Amrita to Raghunam. It's like
also like the creation
you
is...
You get the assist.
The creation is talking about, it's about the material energy of the Lord. So right. In one sense, it's all the energies of the Lord and how it is related to the Lord and how we are related to the Lord. So all, it's and ultimately everything is connected to the Supreme Lord.
Mm-hmm. That's nice. Yeah. Anything else on this point? Jiva?
Hare Krishna.
And you're next.
So... thank you for such a nice relationship to attach it, you know, associated with the Mool Mantra, which is like, you know, the main essence. I was looking back and remembering Srila Prabhupada when he wrote about in Krishna book in chapter 87, the prayers of the Vedas, the personified Vedas. Mm-hmm. And also Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's commentary as why there's talk of creation early on. It actually refers back to, like, in the beginning, people are mainly coming from the karmic background, so they have more interested in the activities, karma kanda. So the creation is discussed multiple times in Bhagavatam to refer to those factors that, you know, what is this material world created of, the three modes of material and, you know, mm-hmm. nature and then the various elements and so forth to get them to detach and understand, get the understanding that it's all coming from Krishna, so it's easier to get detached and gradually progress towards Krishna consciousness.
And that's one of the points, actually, on my list. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Srila Prabhupada writes in the purport that Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, I'm paraphrasing, I don't know if the word warns us or instructs us that we should not be afraid to study how great Krishna is, you know, about his creation and things like that, because that can help be an impetus towards love. Rishi?
And maybe you're coming to this, so I should listen to sort of the full response before asking.
Yeah, I got pages.
Okay. I think the second order question, there are folks in this room who are reading the Bhagavatam for, you know, the 10th, 15th time, whatever it may be. There are some folks who are reading for the first time.
How many for the 10th time? Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, probably.
So for those of us that are reading for the first time, one of the questions when we have less of a sort of easy connection to a verse or set of verses is, okay, I understand this relates to Krishna, step one. Step two is, how much of this should I retain? And I don't know if the answer is as much as you can, or if it's, you know, when you're reading for the first time, what are you trying to do with these types of verses? There are some verses, yes, they're direct, you know, Krishna's in the verse, and you're not going through, like, this, you know, creation story that's very far removed, and you have to go all the way back to the second chapter.
These are great questions. It's a whole another set of questions.
Yeah. So it comes down to what's my duty on sort of my initial reads.
Well, and it's great because there's different ways to read. The SGGS, which I mentioned the other day, the Sangha of gurus, GBCs, and sannyasis. This year when I was helping to facilitate it, one of the ideas was to try to come up with some action, not just nice sangha, but some plant, you know, something that these people could do. So one of the focuses was on encouraging people to read Prabhupada's books. So then you had Keshava Bharati Maharaj, who is encouraging devotees to read 41 pages a day. I told you this before, because 41 pages means you'll finish the Bhagavatam in a year. Okay. And he even has it, I think I sent it out on email, electronically. Although right now, if you notice, I'm going old school. I'm using a book. I forgot what they were for, but. But then you have, and I could also send this out to you if anyone's interested, Burijan Prabhu wrote a essay once called Prayerful Reading. And he was almost saying the opposite. You read a sentence and you meditate on that sentence. And you try to really understand that before going on. And you may even say some prayers as you're reading that sentence to help you understand it more. And you're not going for quantity, but for realization and entering a prayerful mood. So we read for purification, because the Bhagavatam is Krishna, right? And it is associating with Krishna, it's associating with Prabhupada, associating with the previous acharyas, it's associating with Sukadeva Goswami. It's associating with Hiranyakasipu. No, you actually, as Prabhupada writes in the fifth chapter of the first canto, I believe, he thanks Narada Muni for so kindly appearing on the pages of this chapter. So, you know, as a matter of fact, and well, that's a good time to read. This is just part of the. We started reading them, and then I got lazy and stopped showing them on the chart. But this is from Sanatan Goswami. O Srimad Bhagavatam, O nectar churned from the ocean of all Vedic scriptures, O most prominent transcendental fruit of all the Vedas, O you who are enriched with the jewels of all spiritual philosophical conclusions, O you who grant spiritual vision to all the people of the world, O life breath of the Vaishnava devotees, O Lord, you are the sun which has arisen to dispel the darkness of the Kali Yuga. You are actually Lord Krishna who has returned among us. O Srimad Bhagavatam, I offer respectful obeisances unto you. By reading you, one attains transcendental bliss. And listen to this. This connects to the first point I was making. For your syllables, each syllable, rain pure love of God unto the reader. You are always to be served by everyone, for you are an incarnation of Lord Krishna. So, two nights ago, my wife and I had dinner with Hari Kirtan and Elizabeth. I think everyone knows them. And they're studying the Bhagavatam every day together. And this is Elizabeth's first rodeo. rodeo wouldn't be the right word. Has anyone been to a rodeo? I've been to a lot of them because of my work. There's rodeos out west. So we wouldn't want to use that word, I think, in Krishna consciousness, you know, roping cows and things like that, or bulls. First time that she's read it. We'd have to ask her, but she seems like she was reading it for, not to memorize it. Like when I'm giving a class, right, I need to read it in a certain mood, right, to understand it enough so I can explain it, right, and to try to look at different angles of vision and think about things and like that, because I have to, you know. So that's one way, right? And as I think anyone knows, anyone who teaches, you learn is probably the best way to learn, right? Is to teach something. But she just finds, she was saying how it's like putting on, I'm using my words now, not hers, but looking at the world through a whole different lens. And she finds it so helpful. I was so encouraged to see how encouraged she was. You know, reading the Bhagavatam for the first, and she's not like she's not a everything's rosy colored glasses kind of person, right? She's quite a discerning person. But she was also even talking about how, we were both talking about this, how, you know, what's happening politically in this country right now, for people we know, people I know at work and people that she works with, it's devastating. To them, because they so much identify, you know, they wake up sometimes and think that, you know, this is our leadership now, you know. And she was saying how the Bhagavatam helps her not see beyond that, and see another reality. So that might, I'm not exactly sure how to what to call that, but I think that is a good way to read the Bhagavatam the first time, to become familiar. I think it's good if we can to have an overall familiarity. First canto, Queen Kunti, Bhishma's passing away, et cetera, et cetera. Second canto, Chatur Shloki, Bhagavatam, things like third canto, Maitreya and Vidura, and then we're going to hear about Kapila Dev. You know, that's, I think, not hard to do, really. And then just to read it as regularly as we can to, see, like I said, put on a different way of different worldview, to ask different kinds of questions. That's going to be the topic of the Sunday open house class today, about questions. And then there's studying it. Now, ideally, the way it's been set up, we're calling this Bhakti Vaibhava, right? And the Bhakti Vaibhava in ISKCON is more rigorous than what we're doing, I'll be quite frank. There's a lot more exams, there's memorization of shlokas, and it's usually done in the holy dham, where people don't have pretty much anything, that's their main service. There's some devotees who are doing it out in the West. Hanumat Prashek Maharaj is doing it in a few places, sometimes by phone. And I made the choice that, because they get a very small group, they get like five people, so I made a choice to try to make this more general, and making the reading and the homework and stuff optional. Like that. And by the way, I will have certificates for you for the second canto, because finally Murari is back from India and he can do the printing, because I don't have a secretary. Yeah. So that will be done, maybe even this week, if I can buy the certificate, blank certificates at Staples. So reading for purification, basic familiarity, seeing the world differently, then there's studying it, and then there's to teach it. Maybe that's kind of, does that help at all?
Yeah. I mean, in another way, sometimes I think of it as I'm reading to get to the 10th canto, and you have to go in order to get there. And so.
Shanaka Rishi Prabhu tells a story about Keith Ward. Keith Ward is a very prominent theologian. I don't know if he's still alive now or not. Very prominent theologian at Oxford University. Did you meet him? Yeah, okay. So maybe you know the story. But one time, and he really helped the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies get established and helped Shonaka a lot doing that. So one time Shonaka gave him a gift of the Bhagavatam, and he was reading it. He's a scholar. So Shonaka said, you got the books? And he was already through, like, you're not like us. He actually like read them, But the funny thing was that Shonaka tells the story is that when he kept on reading, where Srila Prabhupada said, don't skip ahead to the 10th canto, he said, I could not resist. He skipped ahead to the 10th canto. Lord Chaitanya really, I mentioned this last week, that he really liked the pastimes of Prahlad Maharaj. So he's Sri Krishna Chaitanya, Radha Krishna Nahe Anya. He is Radha and Krishna. So you would think he would skip ahead to the 10th canto. But he really was inspired by Prahlad Maharaj. So it is written in a progression for a reason. However, if you want to read the 10th canto, go ahead. You may want to read the Krishna book first. We used to have the idea of philosophy in the morning and Leela in the evening. Right? So the classic thing when you're getting married in ISKCON in the old days is you have hot milk and Krishna book. And that was your dating. So that was my wife and I. We would date by having hot milk and read Krishna book together. And now when she tells young couples, don't just have hot milk and Krishna book. Find out about each other. So a few other things I had here. I did briefly mention this last week also. We have a particular taste where it's not plain vanilla. Everything has to be the same. we all have our certain things that we really are inspired by in Krishna consciousness. So if you have that spark, fan it. We should all have a basic attraction to chanting, since that's the yuga dharma, right? So chanting you can't kind of avoid, right? But this is from the Nectar of Devotion. Sri Rupa Goswami affirms herein that there are 9 different kinds of devotional service, which are listed as, and we all know these, hearing, chanting, remembering, serving, worshiping the deity in the temple, praying, carrying out orders, serving him as a friend, and sacrificing everything for him. Each and every one of these processes is so powerful that if anyone follows even one single one of them, he can achieve the desired perfection without fail. For example, if one is attached simply to hearing about the Lord and another is attached to chanting the glories of the name, both will achieve their desired goal in devotional service. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, this has been explained. One may execute 1, 2, 3, or all the different processes of devotional service, and at the ultimate end, he will achieve the desired goal of being established in devotional service. So I chose that as a partial answer to your question, because even within the Bhagavatam, there may be things that we're more attracted to. You know, there's Rasaraj Prabhu, when he reads the Bhagavatam, he thinks quantum physics. Right? And how can I use the Bhagavatam to and marry that with modern science? You know, right? And so it's just like, in a mundane way, I've given this example before. You don't notice things until you're focused on it, right? Like if you're buying a new car, all of a sudden as you're driving around everywhere, you're noticing all the different cars, right? And similarly, I think when we're reading the Bhagavatams or Bhagavad Gita or whatever, something is on our mind, it'll jump out of us at the page, right? When we're, you know, focusing on that. So I don't think it's terrible to say, well, you know, personally, I really like the 9th chapter of the Gita more than the 16th or something like that. However, we should also understand that anything spoken by Krishna is pretty cool. Any thoughts on that so far? Yes, Mataji. You need a microphone.
Hare Krishna. So I have found extremely helpful while studying scriptures, particularly Bhagavatam. In the beginning of each chapter, usually, I mean, that too, if you are reading from vedabase.com, there is a summary of the chapter.
Mm-hmm. And so getting an overview.
Yeah, that's just me maybe, and I've expressed to you in the past also when we were doing Bhakti Shastri. Mm-hmm. It's really helpful if we get an overview before starting a chapter, kind of mind gets prepared what we are going to study in certain sequence, what is mm-hmm. to follow. And that too, if we have no background, I mean, we may have some background, but really, you know, to get more insight. Mm-hmm. And then when we are done with the chapter, and as you go to the chapter, anyway, you relate what we have done in the past and what we are going to study in future. But towards the end, also a very brief conclusion. So this is what we have covered. So kind of, even if we tend to forget what we have been reading for past several weeks, that gives us a snapshot. Yes, this is what I covered totally. And we don't lose touch with what we have covered. So the continuity is maintained.
Yes.
And that's very helpful.
I agree. Rasapriya Mataji, who listens on SoundCloud to all these, I don't know all of them, but she seems to, because she asked me questions. She asked me to do that, and I have been doing it, but I think I missed last chapter. But it is a good idea, because we can get lost, quote unquote, in the purports, because they can be so long, you lose the storyline, so to speak. So, yes, and that's one of the reasons that Bhurijan Prabhu wrote his book, because it gives an overview of what we're studying. And was there one last one here? Oh, this is a continuation of that Nectar Devotion. The idea is that we should follow in the footsteps of great devotees. If we are unable to execute all the different items of devotional service, we must try to execute at least one of them, as exemplified by previous acharyas. So, anyway, it was just a follow-up on that there are, you know, we have our thing in Krishna consciousness, right? If we're really into deity worship, right, or really into distributing Srila Prabhupada's books, or really into studying, or really into chanting, that's okay. That's good. That's actually Krishna's kindness, that we have a particular interest in Krishna consciousness. The only thing we can't really say, nah, chanting, yeah, it's for neophytes. That one we can't really, that's like, what is it, a prerequisite at college? You have, there's certain courses you have to take, Physics 101, at least when I was getting a Bachelor of Arts, had to take English 101, you know, prerequisites before you got your degree. So the prerequisite is chanting. Besides that, take, you know, 404 level, 400 level courses and whatever. Anything else on this? Yes, microphone.
In the Madhya Leela, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says the nine processes that you described just now, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says all of them can be accomplished just by chanting God's names. Yes. So he just simplifies the process like anything and says, like, just chant God's names.
Right. And so, but yes, so Srila Prabhupada performed such austerities to write these books, and he would often say that these books are for us, not just for, you know, I've told that story, they're not just an export business only, he said. Yet for someone who's not a philosophically inclined or even illiterate, okay, chant Hare Krishna, no problem. Yeah, so different shlokas for different folks is the conclusion there. Do you feel we've covered your topic, all right? It's a great question. Okay, now for something completely different. The Srimad Bhagavatam. If you don't know that reference, don't worry about it. text 26? Wait a second. Did we do 24? I don't think we did, because I was going to say something about 24. Let's start with 23, okay? Is that all right, Raghunanda? All right, so text 23, chapter 8. Brahma could see that on the water there was a gigantic lotus-like white bedstead, the body of Sheshanaga, on which the personality of Godhead was lying alone. The whole atmosphere was illuminated by the rays of the jewels bedecked. I'm trying to do two things at once here. Hold on. I can't multitask very well, which is probably a good thing. The whole atmosphere was illuminated by the rays of the jewels bedecking the hood of Seshanag, and that illumination dissipated all the darkness of those regions. The luster of the transcendental body of the Lord, text 24, mocked the beauty of the coral mountain. The coral mountain is very beautiful, dressed by the evening skies, which I don't know if you've seen coral, but imagine a mountain made of coral, and then the light of the evening sky shining on it. Even in the movies, right, they call that the magic hour, right? They wait all day for certain scenes just before, as the sun is setting, and the glow that it has on the faces of the actors and actresses. But the yellow dress of the Lord mocked its beauty. There is gold on the summit of the mountain, but the Lord's helmet, bedecked with jewels, mocked it. The mountains, waterfalls, herbs, etc., with a panorama of flowers, seem like garlands, but the Lord's gigantic body and his hands and legs, decorated with jewels, pearls, tulsi leaves, and flower garlands, mocked the scene on the mountain. And this is an interesting purport where Srila Prabhupada says, the panoramic beauty of nature, which strikes one with wonder, may be taken as a perverted reflection of the transcendental body of the Lord. One who is therefore attracted by the beauty of the Lord is no longer attracted by the beauty of material nature. Listen to this, though. Although he does not minimize its beauty. So, let me hear from you guys. What are some of the most beautiful things you've seen in nature or places? Yes? Microphone.
When I was on a yogi path, studying the impersonal Brahma.
Yes.
I had a really beautiful visualization. I live on the Blue Ridge.
Oh, do you?
And it's full of blue stone.
Uh-huh.
It's unique to the region. And when it's wet, it shines.
Wow.
And when it dries, it gets bluer and light blue, so it changes colors. And I had a vision that Jesus was the ridge.
Uh-huh.
The body of blue was the body of Brahma. My visualization at that time, at that level, was that high, that point. And so I wrote in my poetry that I rest, I live, I come from the ridge.
Oh, nice.
I could see because I slept there, and my water comes from the mountain, from that area on a well, that how intricately I was in there. And I saw the face of what they refer to as the Inca god in Peru on a mountain. And the sunlight at the solstice hits the forehead when it comes up, and it's this very sacred space. And I think it inspired me to see my vision of the Lord Jesus, where I lived on the Blue Ridge in this very, very special.
Which state was that in?
I live in West Virginia, just south of Harper's Ferry now.
Yeah, I know exactly where that is.
Come visit. Yeah, it's a sacred space. It's the first homes to be built up there were the ones that we're living in now.
National
so it's pure land. Yeah. So
and
I saw
John Denver wrote about
this,
it.
This, how I live and am one with that.
Okay, so
experience.
The Blue Ridge Mountains. Wonderful. What else, other places that you've seen that are just absolutely gorgeous? Where?
Niagara Falls.
Niagara Falls, okay. If you know, you must have been to some amazing places in your life. Yes. What are some of the most beautiful places you've been to?
I was thinking of Niagara Falls.
Niagara Falls.
Tell us.
To Niagara Falls. Anyone else?
I think I like Maine.
Maine. Arcadia National Park.
Arcadia National Park. When you see from top, and it's so beautiful. It catch you, right there.
Wonderful. Where else? Yes, Kiva?
South Africa.
Where?
South Africa.
Which part?
Yeah.
Well, the sun rising in South Africa. Sure. Okay. Yes, Kiva?
Temple room.
The temple room. Oh, my God. He cheated.
Most beautiful.
He read ahead. Where else? Yes. Which waterfront? Connecticut.
You go early in the morning.
Long Island Sound?
Yeah,
I was on the other. I lived on the other side of the Sound on Long Island.
It's just like pilings, and these birds are just sitting there. Like they're not doing anything. They're not looking around. They're just sitting there.
Wow.
And you know, water's still. It's only once in a while that the water is really still, and they're all just sitting there. It's like they're. I don't know what they're doing. They're like doing nothing, but it's like everything is waiting for something to happen.
Amrita, you've been to a lot of places.
I actually haven't been to this place, so I'm surprised they didn't mention it. New Zealand, it's really beautiful. Rishikesh went, and his pictures from there, out of this world.
Yeah, New Zealand.
I know, I'm living by
it. I've been to New Zealand, I liked it a lot, actually, Champak?
Kenya, a natural spring, and then this retreat center where you can overlook this entire like safari range with all of the wildlife.
Wow. How about the young ladies in the back? What is the most beautiful places you've seen on Earth? Any place you saw that was really beautiful?
Vrindavan.
Where?
Vrindavan.
Vrindavan, okay, parts of Vrindavan.
No.
Okay. Anyone else? Grand Canyon is quite awe-inspiring. Yes.
Haribol, the ocean views are so beautiful.
Which
when you
ocean?
Look at deep Atlantic Ocean is what I'm thinking of right now.
Uh-huh.
Deep blue.
Deep blue, yes.
Just deep blue.
So I guess I fit to a lot of places in this life. Lake Louise, in part of Banff National Park. It's this turquoise water with the background is mountains, and so the mountains are reflected on the water. And it's, as my mom would say, gorgeous. Yes.
It is.
Go ahead, Fatima.
Driving through Vermont.
Driving through Vermont.
The trees are just gorgeous, just beautiful there.
Yeah, and you just can't, you got to somehow make sure you're looking at the road while you're doing that.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's like, yeah. And so these, think of all these gorgeous places, and you've been to Hawaii, right? That's, some places in Hawaii are just like crazy beautiful, right? Uh-huh, yeah. Swamp at dawn? The light come, I'm just, because you're not using the mic, the light coming through the glass, grass, different colors, yeah. Material world, there's some beautiful places here, isn't it? Yeah, so the Himalayas, some of them are just like, you know, they're just awe-inspiring. Full moon? Full moon. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The sunset. I was just there the other day. Sunset and on the Gulf Coast of Florida. It's quite amazing. So, but here, so now we've just pictured some really amazing places on the in the world. So then take that and then reread the sentence, right? One who is therefore attracted by the beauty of the Lord is no longer attracted by the beauty of material nature, although he does not minimize its beauty. So the point is not to minimize all those places we just spoke about, but just to say, imagine the beauty of the creator of that beauty. And how beautiful, you know, if you think Lake Louise or Hawaii or the swamp in the morning or the Blue Ridge Mountains or Niagara Falls or Grand Canyon or the retreat in Kenya, right, or Arcadia National Park and or Vrindavan or the temple room, imagine how beautiful Krishna is. So the trick on this one is we may, you know, so if I say, you know, Krishna is 1,000 times more beautiful, whatever, unlimitedly more beautiful than Arcadia National Park, and then you look at Radha Madan Mohan, you might say, yeah, very beautiful, but we may not have that realization. So we have to enter into that relationship to Krishna, and he reveals more and more, or they reveal, Radha and Krishna, reveal more and more their beauty to us. But the great realized souls, and Srila Prabhupada saw so many beautiful places. He really liked Hawaii for beauty. He once said, if there's no enjoyment in the material world, but if there is, it's in Hawaii. Right? And then, if I think I mentioned this before, he gave probably the heaviest lectures in Hawaii to try to cut through that enjoying spirit. You know? He didn't seem so as impressed by mountains. Or at least, you know, he was trying to go on a retreat. He was ill, and they took him to Mount Moritz, is it, in Switzerland? And it was so cold. And he said, this is like Mount Hell. Because he didn't seem to like cold very much. Although, for Krishna service, he tolerated it. He walked the streets of New York in 1966. Okay. So, we're not getting to a lot of verses so far today. But I thought that would be a good thing to talk about beautiful places we've been and then juxtaposition them with Krishna's beauty. Any thoughts on that? Yes, Prabhu. Microphone?
As Brahma is describing the Supreme Lord here, one thing came to my mind is right now we are seeing this all this animation God pictures, like, you know, all this colorful, like, you know, with imagination type of thing. Even in like 5,000 years before, like when Brahma is like seeing this, I can able to see something like that, like, you know, which is unimaginable, like, you know, like really some, you know, very great animation God, like, you know, I can able to visualize that, like, even with that reading, that, like, how he's describing the Lord, right. That was so beautiful. We have a technology, you know, we can able to see, like, animations, but, like, in olden days, there was no that type of description, but, you know, that is something I want to relate.
Yeah, I think our senses were more subtle and clued into nature when we weren't so fixated on screens all day. Yeah.
And one more thing is in Srirangam.
And therefore, it's also probably, yeah, I think it's a fair thing to say that, especially when it was agrarian-based society, more easy to connect the existence of God with your day-to-day life. If it didn't rain, you didn't eat, you know, or whatever, you know, and things like that, yeah.
And as well as like in Srirangam, as they are describing here, as Brahma is describing, the Lord has been installed there. In the, have you heard about Srirangam, which is in
Southern Srirangam.
Srirangam, yeah. Yes. So the whole description as he was describing, you can see the Lord like that there.
Yes. Anyone here been to Srirangam? Not too many. Okay. You have. Nice? Did you like it? No, she's going to say, no, it was terrible. Okay, let's continue. His transcendental body, unlimited in length and breadth, occupied the three planetary systems, upper, middle, and lower. His body was self-illuminated by unparalleled dress and variegatedness and was properly ornamented. I like this idea of variegatedness, because we've talked about this before, but I think it's always good to remember, the spiritual world is not boring, right? It's not gonna be like, oh, geez, you know. I mean, you know the joke I always say, right? Garland making again, you know. You know, it's not, every word is a song, every step is a dance, all the water is like nectar, right? It's not ho-hum. It's not like, you know, well, what are we going to, we're not going to hear all the news about Congress and, you know, the healthcare, you know, what's going to be so boring? It's not going to be boring. The Lord showed his lotus feet by raising them. His lotus feet are the source of all awards achieved by devotional service free from material contamination. Such awards are for those who worship him in pure devotion. The splendor of the transcendental rays of his moon-like toenails and fingernails appeared like the petals of a flower. And Prabhupada writes, the Lord fulfills the desires of everyone just as one desires. Now, you know, there's a footnote to that, right? Because if you read that, the Lord fulfills the desires of everyone just as one desires. Because in other places, Prabhupada would also say, first deserve, then desire, right? But spiritually, it's true. Right? Spiritually, it's true. We have a strong spiritual desire, Krishna will reciprocate with that. And here, the next sentence says, the pure devotees are interested in achieving the transcendental service of the Lord, which is non-different from him. So devotional service, non-different from Krishna, and another place Prabhupada says devotional service, non-different than the spiritual world. So when we're actually absorbed in doing devotional service, service to God with devotion, we're in the spiritual world, at least for that period of time. So like Amrita, when you're with the kids, teaching them something, you are in the spiritual world. When you're taking care of your deities at home, Raghunandan, and you're focused on that, you're in the spiritual world. Like that. It's... Now, you know, 5 minutes later, you might say, well, let's check out, you know, who won the, if my brackets are still doing well in the, you know, in March Madness, then you're not necessarily in the spiritual world. Especially because Michigan lost. But anyway, so we can kind of have one foot in one world and one foot in another. Therefore, the Lord is the only desire of the pure devotees, and devotional service is the only spotless process for achieving his favor. Srila Rupa Goswami says in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu that pure devotional service is jnana karma anavritam. Pure devotional service is without any tinge of speculative knowledge and fruitive activity. So let's look at those words again. Go back to your nectar of devotion class from, like, it seems like another lifetime that we studied that, right? But jnana karma anavritam. Anyone remember what anavritam means? Covered, right. So our bhakti should not be covered by jnana or karma. And what is karma mean in our day-to-day parlance, you know?
Enjoyment.
Yeah, sense enjoyment, looking out for number one, basically, yeah. Or maybe extended number ones, but not God, right? And jnana, it's a little harder to understand maybe. What would it be, jnana? How would that apply to us in practical life or in day-to-day thinking?
Speculative knowledge.
Yeah, okay, so what does that mean to us?
It's like
speculative knowledge, he said.
Knowledge that's not connected to Krishna.
Knowledge that's not connected to Krishna. So the basketball scores? That might be more in karma. Gyan is especially knowledge that leads us to an impersonal understanding. Or, and this is where it gets a little subtle. It could be knowledge that we read in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, verse 11 to 30, for example, or read in the Uddhava Gita that I was just studying. Knowledge that we're not our body. Knowledge that this world is a place of suffering. If we don't make the next step, I'm not this body, I'm spirit soul, I'm Krishna's servants, then that's connecting jnana with bhakti. Okay? But if you just stop at I'm not this body, or I should be renounced, you know, there's no enjoyment in this world, but therefore, that could be jnana, and you just have to add, there's no enjoyment in this world, therefore I should serve Krishna, then you're connected with bhakti. So we want to develop, at least gradually, at, you know, the amount of time in our day that we're actually doing bhakti. We're actually thinking of Krishna with devotion. Even when we're working or things like that, we're connecting that somehow, we're maintaining a family that are devotees of Krishna, right? Just like you have such a great family of your children, and or we're using some of the fruits to serve Krishna, but make that connection as much as we can and try to imbibe get some love out of that heart of ours, right? And try not to have it too covered by karma and always thinking about what's in it for me, and again, just maybe even spiritual knowledge, but no connection to the person Krishna. Okay, any thoughts on that? Any speculations? Okay, text 27. He also acknowledged the service of the devotees and vanquished their distresses by his beautiful smile. Isn't that a nice vision? Krishna, you know, we talked about that, I think, last week, where devotees would come to Sri Prabhupada with a big problem, and then Prabhupada would say, is everything all right? And they'd just say, yep. <You know? clears throat> The reflection of his face, decorated with earrings, was so pleasing because it dazzled with the rays of his lips and the beauty of his nose and eyebrows. In the purport, devotional service to the Lord is very obliging to him. That's a pretty amazing sentence to think that God can be obliged to us. So, anyone remember the Gaurapurnima lecture by Garuda Prabhu? This was his point. He was saying that Krishna actually is a liar. He was saying it tongue in cheek, right? Because Krishna says in the Gita, "Yeya tamam prapadyante tamstitaiva bhajamyaham." As people surrender unto me, I reciprocate with them. I promise to reciprocate. But the gopis loved Krishna so much, he couldn't reciprocate their love. So he said, he didn't tell the truth in that sense, right? So here, devotional service to the Lord is very much obliging to him. There are many transcendentalists in different fields of spiritual activities, but devotional service to the Lord is unique. So this is that separating of karma, jnana, and bhakti. Again, it's unique to devotional service is unique. There's many transcendentalists, many ideas. Devotees do not ask anything from the Lord in exchange for their service. Even the most desirable liberation is refused by devotees, although offered by the Lord. So I'm actually going to bring this up in the Sunday open house talk today, but this was Prabhupada's point, that he said, I only really asked my Guru Maharaj one question. Anyone know what the question was?
How can I serve you?
That's right. How can I serve you? Right. So it says here, the devotees do not ask anything from the Lord in exchange for their service. And I was saying that one, because the talk today is about questions, so I'm going to say that One question is why ISKCON exists today, right? Because the answer was, go to the West and teach Krishna consciousness. That will benefit you and benefit those you come in touch with. So that one question. So even the most desirable, I mean, isn't, come on, liberation, no society, no kanchati, no lamenting, no hankering, no problems. That sounds like, wow, that's really good. But far beyond that is entering a loving relationship with Krishna with all of its challenges and curves and some anxieties. Is Krishna pleased by, you know, so many things, but that rasa, that relationship is so great. Thus the Lord becomes a kind of debtor to the devotees, and he can only try to repay the devotees' service with his ever-enchanting smile. So that's our payment, right? We work really hard for Krishna all day long. What's our payment? Spiritual master Krishna smile upon us before we take rest. That's it. The devotees are ever satisfied by the smiling face of the Lord, and they become enlivened. And by seeing the devotees so enlivened, the Lord himself is further satisfied. So there is a continuous transcendental competition between the Lord and his devotees by such reciprocation of service and acknowledgement. Isn't that nice? Or is it just me? It's nice, huh? Any thoughts on this? Yes, Andy, microphone. Tap it and see if it works.
It's working. Oh, yeah. No, I just had a minor insight while you were reading those words.
Okay. We go from minor, major, intermediate.
Well, it's minor because I had it. But no, but Prabhupada did all he did, right, and became a very famous person and everything. But the original impetus was not because he wanted to do it. In other words, he might have not even wanted to do it. Like your master asks you to do something, you say, okay, I'm going to do it, and you don't really feel any real feeling, but you say, well, I want to do it just because he wanted me to.
Right.
But then when you think about other people that accomplish these great things and become very famous, some of them have a lot of problems, they take drugs, or they...
I think the microphone just died. Hold on, because you're not making a minor point, you're making a very wonderful point. So here comes a different colored microphone.
Okay. All right. Okay. No, it's just like the accidental tourist. So if you end up doing something very monumental, just out of pure service, you always like have that attitude like, well, I didn't really want to do this to begin with, like deep inside. So you're not affected by the fame and any ruination from it, because you just accomplished it out of pure someone else's desire, really, that told you you should do this. And then you, through pure service, that's just the little idea.
You just summarized the entire Bhagavad Gita in 2 minutes.
Not so long.
No, you summarized the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna didn't want to fight at the beginning, right? But and Krishna gave so many things, but he finally just said, do it because I'm asking you. And he didn't do it for fame. He didn't do it for, So that's just not those distractions on the path of bhakti. You know, we put our blinders on and we just stay on the path that I'm doing this as a humble servant. And it's funny, without desiring fame, without wanting prestige, or they may come, right? The most famous people in the world are spiritual people, right? The people that, you know, Jesus. 2,000 years later, you know, but someone who was a great king is like, oh, who is that? You know. So yes, that's the spirit, and it's even explained in philosophical points in the 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, verses 26 and 27, where in 27 Krishna says, "Yat karosi, yat asnasi, yat jahosi, didasi yat." He says, basically saying, whatever you normally are, you're going to do so many things. He says, it's okay, you're going to do all those things, so do them for me. But the verse before that says, patram pushpam phalam toyam yome bhakta prayachati. It says that Krishna says, do this, offer me a leaf, a flower, fruit and water. Don't do what you want to do first. Do, this is what I'm telling you to do, leaf. And if you offer it, and he mentions the word bhakti twice in that verse, and Krishna says, asnami, I accept it. So the great teachers, the great acharyas, juxtapose those two verses to say that one is karma yoga, nothing wrong with it. It's a great, Prabhupada quoted that verse a lot. You're going to do something, do it for Krishna. But bhakti is, you hear, you get the order from above, and you execute. That does not mean, by the way, that we can't have our own impetus. You know, I think I'd like to start this project for Krishna. I think I'd like to do, you know, that's not, they're not mutually exclusive like that. But the, it's more the point that the verse 26 has the word bhakti in it twice. So thank you. That was great. Beautiful. We could end right there for like eternity, and we just have Andy's lessons, Andy's realizations to keep us going. So let's carry on then. We're going to read through these verses. I don't think it's only a few more, and then we'll go on to the next chapter. We may comment on a little bit. Oh, my dear Vidura, the Lord's waist. This is just, so just try to envision these beautiful parts of Krishna. The Lord's waist was covered with yellow cloth resembling the saffron dust of the kandamba flower, and it was encircled by a well-decorated belt. His chest was decorated with the Srivatsa marking and a necklace of unlimited value. As a sandalwood tree is decorated with fragrant flowers and branches, the Lord's body was decorated with valuable jewels and pearls. He was the self-situated tree, the Lord of all others in the universe. And as a sandalwood tree is covered by many snakes, so the Lord's body was also covered by the hoods of Ananta. Like a great mountain, the Lord stands as the abode of all moving and non-moving living entities. He is a friend of the snakes because Lord Ananta is his friend. As a mountain has thousands of golden peaks, so the Lord was seen with the thousands of golden helmeted hoods of Ananta Nag. And as a mountain is sometimes filled with jewels, so also his transcendental body was fully decorated with valuable jewels. As a mountain is sometimes submerged in the ocean water, so the Lord is sometimes submerged in the water of devastation. Lord Brahma, thus looking upon the Lord in this, now, you know, for some of us, we might be, oh, come on, this is really hard to explain. This is Lord Brahma's vision, and he probably has better than 20/20. He has 80/80 at least, right? Times four. The Lord thus looking upon, Lord Brahma, thus looking upon the Lord in the shape of a mountain, concluded that he was Hari, the personality of Godhead. He saw that the garland of flowers on his chest glorified him with Vedic wisdom in sweet songs and looked very beautiful. He was protected by the Sudarshan wheel for fighting, and even the sun, moon, air, fire, etc. could not have access to him. When Lord Brahma, the maker of the universal devastation, thus saw the Lord, he simultaneously glanced over creation. Lord Brahma saw the lake in Lord Vishnu's navel and the lotus flower as well as the devastating water. So he saw where he came from finally. The drying air in the sky all became visible to him. Lord Brahma thus being surcharged, thank you. Thus being surcharged by the mode of passion, became inclined to create, and after seeing the five causes of creation indicated by the personality of Godhead, he began to offer his respectful prayers on the path of the creative mentality. So, take out the next book. Next chapter, because I want to get to this chapter. Verse 1 has some, this is an amazing chapter, because Brahma is, because it's instructive for us, because he's praying for creative energy. What's up? Did I miss something?
Wait for the next book.
Oh. You thought I was going to be that slow? Oh, ye of little faith.
Good luck.
Brahma's prayers. So he, you know, he realizes, I got a big job to do, and I can't do it just on my own. I need help. That's, you know, that's one of the wonderful things that comes out of this chapter. So in the first verse, Brahma is speaking, and he says, "Oh my Lord, today, after many, many years of penance, I have come to know you. Oh, how unfortunate the embodied living entities are that they are unable to know your personality. My Lord, you are the only knowable object because there is nothing supreme beyond you. If there is anything supposedly superior to you, it is not the absolute. You exist as a supreme by exhibiting the creative energy of matter." So this is his realization, right? You know, because sometimes people say, well, who created God? Right? You've heard that? And, you know, it's a valid question. And the answer here by Lord Brahma is there is nothing beyond you. So he, therefore, and it's Lord Brahma in the Brahma Samhita, right, who says, sarva karna karnam, that you're the cause of all the buck stops Krishna. So let's hear a little bit about this purport. The highest peak of the ignorance of the living entities who are conditioned by material bodies is that they are unaware of the supreme cause of the cosmic manifestation. Different people have different theories regarding the supreme cause, but none of them are genuine. The only supreme cause is Vishnu and the intervening, or God, you know, in generic terms. And the intervening impediment is the illusory energy of the Lord. Anyone have experience of Maya? Only Champak and Ravinandan Prabhu. Okay. Right. It's when I was I think in earlier days of ISKCON we were a little more, you'd hear more classes about Maya. Right. Did you experience that growing up, Amrit? But as Srila Prabhupada, that one statement? My biggest complaint about my devotees is they are not sufficiently afraid of Maya. The Lord has employed his wonderful material energy in manifesting many, many wonderful distractions in the material world. And the conditioned soul, illusioned by the same energy, are thus unable to know the supreme cause. Now, you know this is one of my favorite topics, distractions. Right? And I quote that T.S. Eliot. Is it T.S. Eliot? Yeah. Distracted from distractions by distractions. Yeah. And it goes on to say how one leads a petty life when one does that. And Krishna speaks about this in the Gita, right? Anyone know the verse I'm thinking about in the second chapter? Yep, that's the one. No. No. Vyavasayatmika buddhi ekeha. Now Krishna says that to be successful on the spiritual path, one has to have ekeha, means one, right? Eka, right? One single-minded determination. And then he says bahu shaka. Shaka means what?
Multi-branched.
Branches, right? So one whose intelligence is many-branched, it's hard to have that resolute determination. So we can become, you know, many-branched. There was this one thing I read today. In my own life, the ultimate problem with these distractions, whether it be, this is a monk speaking. I should say a priest. In my own life, the ultimate problem with these distractions, whether it be the evening news, a song I can't get out of my head, or my own stubborn pride, is they keep me from being fully present to God. Fully present to God? Isn't God always with us? Absolutely. But are we always with Him? Are we attentive to Him? Are we fully present to God? So it's, yeah, so I hope I don't repeat myself too much on this, but it's just something that comes to my mind. It's just the modern world is even much more distracted than when I was growing up because of electronics and the internet and cable television, et cetera, et cetera. So it's so easy to get, the class today is about questions. It's so easy to ask other questions. You know, what's happening in the world of politics? What's happening here? Because we have questions throughout our day. we wake up. I did a little test this morning. I woke up, and I tried to see what questions I had as I woke up my mind. So I knew I was going to give a class on questions, so I did immediately think, I better ask some really spiritual questions, like who am I, where have I come from, where am I going? But then I remember my mind went to, are the avocados ripe yet? That was one of the questions that came in my mind. What's the weather like today? That was another question that came in my mind, you know. So we think of questions. If you think about it, we have questions all day long. And we do have to live in this world, so we do have to ask, you know, my dear spouse, did you put gas in the car last night? Because you do need to know whether you're going to run out of gas or not, right? So there are, you know, questions of this world that we have to ask because we live in this world. The problem is whether we're setting enough time aside for asking the big questions. Yeah, because it's very easy in this life to get caught up in all the other questions. It's so easy. There's so many distractions. So it takes some, and that's why we have these books. These books are, as we were talking earlier in Rishi's question, they kind of like put our vision back on higher thinking and more introspection and more. Compassion, as we're hearing now, Brahma's, his point is compassion, right? He's saying, oh, these poor people. And this, the next verse also talks about that. So Prabhupada writes that, continues, the most stalwart scientists and philosophers, therefore, cannot be accepted as wonderful. They only appear wonderful because they are instruments in the hands of the illusory energy of the Lord. Under illusion, the general mass of people deny the existence of the Supreme Lord and accept the foolish products of illusory energy as supreme. So we should really think about the level of distraction we have in life. And we have to have some, but you know, to what extent it is, right? Because we've also in the past talked about multitasking, right? And even the, you know, the statistics about how if you get distracted when you're working on a project, it takes 4 to 7 minutes to get back to the level of productivity you were on before that, you know. And so if we're on our computer, even that's one of the reasons I'm going back to these books as instead of using my computer, because I sometimes get notifications on my computer as I'm reading the Bhagavad Gita, oh, interesting email, or you know, or whatever, and so that way less distractions. But it's something to really think about deeply. Some thoughts?
Hare Krishna. Thank you for the wonderful class.
It's not over yet.
Yes, okay. Yes. But the topic was, again, just such a wonderful topic.
It's just a standard saying we used to say.
So when you read that sentence...
Unless that was a hint
sentence,
that I should stop.
No hint. When you mentioned that, you know, Srila Prabhupada in his purpose writing that the, you know, material energy is employed by the Lord. So I was meditating on that sentence that, you know, Lord is the employer. And as we work as, you know, under an employer, all the facilities are provided by the employer. So Lord is providing all the facilities for the material energy to create all these varieties to distract us. Mm-hmm. So it's so amazing. It's like, you know, and that's why she is so powerful. So even though among the three energies, you know, chit shakti, vedamajana energy, and then the material energy, which is jara, you know, which is immovable on its own, is so powerful and covers us, our vision and our and understanding of our own position is because she is using the facility provided by the Lord.
Yeah, that's right. That's why Maya is so powerful. So therefore, the one way to get out of Maya is only by Krishna's mercy. Other thoughts? Yes.
So one of my recent realization is this Maya, the external energy that acts on us, is to some extent it helps me to get focused. If there is no resistance, that it's that's not true. Giving me a direction. That's one. And I was like praying for that and...
praying for Maya?
No. Praying to basically consistently to turn towards Krishna. Like, okay, I want to do this. I want to serve this. I'm having other challenges. Yes. And if there is no challenges, my mind kicks in. Like mind automatic, if there is no external problem, the mind automatically takes you somewhere. So this always, there should be some resistance. Like I felt the external resistance was much easier to overcome, and I can focus on my consciousness of meditation, the chanting or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Once there is no external problems, the internal problems comes in. Like, yes. So,
yes. And sometimes life will be good. You know, things will be on. You know, kind of going. You know, the lights are turning green and all that stuff. So, the example that Srila Prabhupada gives is of a business person who is makes money when the market's up and makes money when the market's down. So when we're going through suffering, we take shelter of Krishna, like Kunti did, Queen Kunti. And when things are going well, we thank Krishna for making things so easy to serve him. So sometimes, yeah, maybe, you know, yeah. So either way, that's a devotee's approach. Other thoughts on distractions? Okay, well, you guys must not be distracted very much. I guess it's just me. Next verse. The form which I see is eternally freed from material contamination and has advented to show mercy to the devotees as a manifestation of internal potency. This incarnation is the origin of many other incarnations, and I am born from the lotus flower grown from your navel home. So now he knows where he came from. Oh, my Lord, I do not see a form superior to your present form of eternal bliss and knowledge. Now, by the way, you know, we go through these, we breeze through these because we're kind of doing an overview, but there's very specific reasons why, for example, Brahma is praying like this in the verse we just read in this verse, because he's making it clear to the reader that it is not, he's not seeing some impersonal realization, right? He says, I do not see a form superior to your present form of eternal bliss and knowledge. It is your in your impersonal Brahman effulgence in the spiritual sky, there is no occasional change and no deterioration of internal potency. I surrender unto you because whereas I am proud of my material body and senses, your lordship is the cause of the cosmic manifestation, and yet you are untouched by matter. This present form or any transcendental form expanded by the Supreme Personality of Godhead Shri Krishna is equally auspicious for all the universes. Since you have manifested this eternal personal form, so eternal personal, upon whom your devotees meditate, I therefore offer my respectful obeisances unto you. Those who are destined to be dispatched to the path of hell neglect your personal form because of speculating on material topics. So he's getting, you know, he's getting a little preachy there. Oh my Lord, persons who smell the aroma of your lotus feet carried by the air of Vedic sound through the holes of the ears accept your devotional service. For them, you are never separated from the lotus of their hearts. And Srila Prabhupada writes, that is the transcendental relationship between the pure devotee and the personality of Godhead. Because the Lord does not wish to separate himself from the hearts of such pure devotees, it is understood that they are specifically dearer than the impersonalist. The relationship of the pure devotees with the Lord develops because of devotional service to the Lord on the authentic basis of Vedic authority. And this is the sentence I wanted to focus on. Such pure devotees are not mundane sentimentalists, but are factually realists. I won't even read the rest of it, because just meditate on that. We are meant not to be mundane sentimentalists, but factual realists. Okay? Well, before I speak on that, any thoughts on that? We're not to be mundane sentimentalist, but factual reals. Yes, Champakalata.
two things I heard devotees say. One time I was in the car with Naveen Prabhu, and he...
Was he driving?
Yeah.
He must have been very prayerful then.
Yeah, actually, you'll laugh when I tell you one of the things he was saying.
Because I've been in Mauritius, I know how they drive. Go ahead.
He said, he all of a sudden goes, you know, Krishna is God, and God is real, and that's a fact. And then took both of his hands and slapped the steering wheel, you know. And it was just kind of like one of those moments where I was like, yeah. That's right. And and yesterday I was at the Institute and Rajalila was giving class. And one of the things that she said that was really profound was that we identify more with our material body. We're identifying with our material selves. We're not identifying with our spiritual body. We're not identifying with who we are. And so the reason, but Krishna consciousness is all about practicing re-identifying with who we really are and that relationship with Krishna. And that I feel like ties exactly into what you just read, that the more we can uncover that, the more, you know, it becomes a fact for us.
Mm, nice. Thank you. Others? Real? Yes, Raghunandan Prabhu in front. Sisi Gornitai, Sisi Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman. Shishi Radha Madan Mohan.
The impersonalists say that what the devotional process is just sentimentalism, and
yes,
it's only fit for elementary levels of spirituality. But for when you grow higher in the spiritual life, then those sentimentality is not needed. But This is not sentimentalism, but it is reality based on Vedic authority. And when we go by that, then we are not just doing sentimentalism, but we are following the actual process that we are asked to do.
Nice. And it's interesting, right? So sometimes impersonalists may call devotees sentimental, right? Because we're Radhe Radhe, you know what I mean? We're into devotion, right? But interestingly, we might sometimes call certain other religionists a bit sentimental, right? Because you know, some of our classes are about gyan in the bhakti sense of the term, like, you know, this place of suffering, you know, and sometimes you go to a church and it's a lot of it is about love and God is love. And, you know, of course that's our teaching, you know, Bhagavad Gita as well. But, you know, devotees will often kind of harp on the realistic outlook of this world. Right? You know, don't try to enjoy this world, right? Janma, mrityu, jara, vyadi, dukkha, dosha, nidarshanam, right? You know, birth, death, disease, and old age. Keep those in the front of your consciousness. You know, anything you have is going to be finished at the time of death. And what is it? You know, you're climbing the ladder of success and it's leaning against the wrong wall. And, you know, right? And, you know, and then what speak of pungsastriyo maitini bhava metam tayoraho hridaya grantimahu. Aho grihak shetrasu taptavitar janasimo hoyam ahamameti. And the hridaya grand, the worst thing is the connection between man and woman. And, you know, and you've heard devotees talk like this. But, you know, that is realistic. I mean, when I was 17 years old when I heard about Krishna consciousness, but for me that was, yeah. Because I wasn't involved in religiosity. Oh, I went to other people's bar mitzvahs and stuff. So I learned a little Hebrew, but I didn't go to Hebrew school or anything. And it was like, wow. You know, I really liked the fact that it was, you know, stark reality. In addition, though, we want to have the real, accept or try to ultimately experience the realism of the other half of Krishna, kind of the spiritual world and Radha and Krishna and Shisi Gornitai and their pastimes and all that. So we're not meant to be mundane sentimentalists, you know, yatama tatapat, whatever you do, it's all okay. You know, I am you and you are me and we are all together, as the Beatles one song, so, you know, and all those things. No, there's some shastric guidelines that we're meant to follow. But we are realists. And it says, because the activities are supported by Vedic authorities. So we're not sentimentalists, although we want to have loving sentiments towards the devotees, and we need to. That's the path of bhakti. So there's a difference between sentimentalists, which has a negative connotation, and loving sentiments, which has a positive connotation. But we also want to get real, you know, especially when our mind is traveling all over the universe. And then we have to tell our mind, mind, get real. You're actually not going to live forever. Right? And therefore, get serious about spiritual practices. This is not a rehearsal. Life, what is it? Life is not a dress rehearsal. It's the real show. So we don't want to go through life just kind of thinking it's kind of a dress rehearsal. Oh, I have so much time to be, you know, to ask serious questions and things like that. I just found that, you know, as someone who's going to be teaching this, as I'm reading it, I'm looking for sentences or points that jump out at me and think that would be good for us to talk about. So that one really jumped out. Some other thoughts about this: factual realists and not mundane sentimentalists. Jiva Thaprabhu.
Hare Krishna.
You have to pick on him because he controls the microphone. Yeah.
Oh. Yes, today's my third comment. I realize.
But who's counting?
So, one of the things when I was reading the purport, I was reminded by, you know, some of the sayings, and Einstein's saying was, education is what stays with you after you're out of the college or out of the institution. I'm paraphrasing that saying. So it kind of made me realize that sometimes, you know, that gyan karma avritam that can come into our heart because we are like, oh, I've done bhakti shasti, I'm doing bhakti vaibhav, and realize that instead of becoming hard, we're actually supposed to be becoming more humble, more tolerant, more accepting to the society, and looking beyond the covering of this body for all the living entities, to become more conscious of the very existence and of the environment, because sometimes what we just take for granted is great privilege we're getting. And Krishna consciousness is the greatest gift to us by Srila Prabhupada. And he's coming as this messenger of the Lordship, and he's giving us this, which is enlivening. We are coming back to come to our own, you know, realization. On each one of us have our own path as we come to realize. So again, it's when I'm thinking on those terms, I'm realizing that sentimentalist and realist, means again, there's such a fine line. Because
there is a fine line, yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Because, yes. Yeah, well, like when I got my Bhakti Shastri degree, I told my wife, I passed the Bhakti Shastri. And she said, yes, you are definitely full of BS. On that note, let's end the class for today. The homework assignment will be, I'll send out the verses, but basically we're going to attempt to finish this chapter next week, because Rishi hasn't asked any questions at the end to have us spend the first half hour of next week's class on that, which, by the way, I'm joking, it was actually really good. I thought that was a really good discussion we had on that point. So have a very wonderful week in Krishna consciousness. Hare Krishna, all glories to Srila Prabhupada.